Hello, you're listening to Lifeguard IT, a podcast about diving into the deep end of enterprise IT. Brought to you by Lakeside Software.
An industry leader in workspace analytics, Lakeside Software has been helping organizations improve their end-user experience for over 20 years. Our unique method of endpoint data collection helps enable business productivity by providing you with key insights into your users, the business processes that encompass their jobs, and the technologies they use to get work done. From continuously monitoring your end users' experiences to planning for your next transformation project, Lakeside's analytics suite helps you optimize your environment every step of the way.
To learn more, visit www.lakesidesoftware.com. Hello, this is your host, Heather Bicknell, also joined today again by my co-host, Linda Sow. Today, we're going to be talking to you about enterprise user experience. How do you improve it? What are some of the considerations there? Recently, we conducted a survey with a company called IDG and found that 100% of IT decision makers are invested in the end user experience at their companies, with 100% of respondents saying that they are measuring it in one way or another. So here with us to talk about that is Ryan Purvis, who is a digital workplace strategist at a global bank. He has 14 years of experience working in the real estate and banking industries, and to date has supported around 430,000 users. So Ryan, thanks for being with
here. Thank you for the opportunity.
With us today. Yeah. Great to talk to you about this stuff. So yeah, I think we'll just start to get into this topic, just sort of talking about what do we want end users to have at their workplaces? Like, what is your ultimate vision for end users in the workplace?
So what we see is this more blended environment between working with in a results-driven culture and a lifestyle-balanced workplace. So the ability to work mobile, anytime, anywhere, any place, on any device, and then having that blend with the work that you have to do at home and the work you have to do in the office, and collaborating with people in different regions and locales. Some way to have that in a manner where some of these new modern technologies or approaches like AI will help you to reduce the noise in your environment and have your tools being more suitable for what your job is, and you can do more constructive work or more brain work in your time in the office or at the office.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a great vision, but obviously it's one that presents some challenges from the IT perspective.
So I personally have noticed that any companies out there that say, like, we have the best end user computing solution out here, that they're more like a data spit back than adding context around the data. So there's no like reasoning or any sort of context around like, okay, why is my system failing or why is my boot login time so slow kind of thing.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, so the problem that I have and some of my colleagues is there's a premonition that having more data will give you more answers, as opposed to having processed information to give you some insight that'll tell you a little bit of which way to go on where the problem is potentially. There's also the end-to-end portion to this, which is you have to bring your own device category now, which you didn't have to before. Also, the end users are used to a different experience in the consumer market that didn't exist 5-10 years ago, where they go to an Apple store now and they get a genius that will deal with their problem, and it's a lockdown environment. Whereas the enterprise used to be the lockdown environment that was leading that sort of way. The other piece of that is, you know, when you provide a hot desk environment where a user might sit at this desk on one day, sit in another building tomorrow, fly to another country, but they're logging into a virtual desktop that's hosted in a data center, you have other things that you need to factor in. So to get that end-to-end piece, more data actually makes it more difficult. So you do need something that is connecting the dots for you and actually pointing at, you know, potentially this dot being the broken chain, or portion of the chain at least, in trying to solve the problem and get a good stable environment for your end user.
Yeah, I think that sets the stage for some of the challenges ahead of those working in IT. You know, Gartner their opinion, what they've said about the digital workplace is that it enables new, more effective ways of working. It raises employee engagement and agility, and it exploits consumer-oriented styles and technologies, which I think really gets to what you were saying, Ryan, about how, you know, the sort of the flip from the enterprise gives you the most up-to-date technology to really being the users at the forefront of, the employees are at the forefront of who are the users, who's setting the needs and expectations. So less provisioning from IT as we traditionally think of it, but more what figuring out what your users need and how you can enable them. So I guess I'm curious to hear from you, Ryan, if you've sort of experienced a shift in your own career. I know Gartner, for instance, has predicted that by 2021, 40% of IT staff will be versatilists, their term for it, holding multiple roles, most of which will be business rather than technology related. Do you sort of agree with that prediction? Do you feel things moving in that direction?
Well, I mean, my career has always been generous. I mean, I started off as a software developer. I did a bit of project management, a bit of architecture. I've worked as a relationship manager, you know, between IT and the business. So I've always had to be a generalist. And I think that's always been a better state for me that sort of suits my personality. What I'm finding in general conversation is more business people are becoming more technology educated. So the conversations you're having with them are much more, I say much more technical, but they're asking questions based on understanding more than they did sort of 5 years ago. And this comes back to the consumerization of technology. So yes, I mean, I had a discussion with my niece recently. She's just done an accounting degree, and she asked what she should do next. I said, learn Python. Because if you don't know how to process data and understand data, you're going to suffer, because some bot will be able to do that. So I think there is a cross-pollination from both sides. I think business has to become more tech, and tech has to become more business. And I also think with AI and some of those sort of things, you're going to need to be able to talk to a computer, to train that computer to do some of the stuff that you don't want to do. And that may take the form of you writing some piece of code. And you may be, as I say, an accountant writing the code, or you might actually be speaking and it converting very much like Alexa converts, you know, skills right now. You know, give me the flash briefing today and you'll get a list of things. It could be giving my stock price, giving my my daily journal, and that'll all be stuff that you'd have to teach. So I think it's both ways.
It's interesting that you bring up the bots, because we just... I don't know if you heard in our last podcast that Microsoft is trying to release a smart bot like that, that is able to answer those kind of easier general questions. So where do you think that would play in the workplace? Just kind of like that? Or do you see it like growing?
There's a couple things. So transformation of a business is a good opportunity for a bot. So if we're moving a user from physical to virtualized desktop, traditionally you'd run up a big program, you'd have a bunch of people doing planning and scheduling and testing and packaging of software for the new platform. You'd have to manage users in batches or ad hoc to move them across. And that requires some interaction with the end user and explaining what they're moving on to and answering their questions and being available and that kind of stuff. All those sort of things can be easily handled by a bot, where, you know, they can ask a question, what is VDI, and get an answer. And not necessarily a blurb that's, you know, I'll say robotic to be the pun, but it is fairly nuanced with jargon, and it can be multi-language and available 24/7. And, you know, those questions can go to the bot first, and if the bot can't answer after, you know, a couple tries, then go to a human. So you've got a level of triage that's handled by the bot and can learn from, you know, using machine learning to improve that interaction. Other things that are useful there are things like scheduling the transfer. So when we move someone to VDI, we obviously take away a laptop or a desktop. There's a need to switch over at some point and replace that with a thin client and a new, you know, we've in multiple places replaced the desktops with thin clients with a big screen and a better keyboard and a better mouse. But you still got to get that physical asset back from the user. A lot of them don't want to give it away easily. So there's a bit of back and forth, and the bot just helps, you know, that interaction a bit better. I think also once you've put someone on the platform, there's an opportunity to follow up with that user, which traditionally, if you relied on a human to do it, they probably wouldn't do it, because they'd be given more work to do that, and they'd be trying to do the next priority work. But the bot would be on a schedule, so it'll just know that after, you know, 21 days or 14 days or some random period, talk to the user and ask them, you know, how's it going? We've moved you on. What do you think? How do you feel? You know, sort of survey questions. And that could feed back, which could then go back to the project team or the operations team to actually go and have a, you know, a face-to-face discussion or a teleconference or whatever it is. So I just think it'll become more and more prevalent to have those sorts of scenarios. I also think in some of the KPIs that we're collecting and we're looking at, you could drive behaviors of the bots to go and talk to the user and say, well, we saw this drop in your health score, for example. What were you doing at this point in time? Or from a surveillance point of view, even a risk point of view, you normally only log in between 8 and 5. Why are you logging at 6 in the morning? You know, protecting the bank or protecting the organization. So there's those things where, you know, again, not having someone sitting there watching the glass, the bot could be available just to have that interaction.
So that would that be more like in addition to data that you would be collecting from the user already, like kind of following their metrics? And you mentioned like the bot noticing a trend abnormality. Would like the survey be in addition to that?
Well, I mean, so it's an integrated solution either way. You've got to have a when we look at the data we're collecting and GDPR, which is coming in next year, there's quite a lot around that, around individuals' privacy and what data you're collecting and having consent for that and being very specific to what you're collecting, why you're collecting it, and what you're going to use it for, that the user has to agree to. And also has, they have the ability to ask you to delete that data, and you have to be able to delete it to, you know, a reasonable state. So there's a need to tie it all together in a way that the user will understand it. So you have to cover that aspect to it. But you're not just looking at sensors on your desktop. You're looking at things from the badge swipe when they come into the office in the morning, or logging off their phone. You know, however you provide the service to the end user, that's when you have to have some sort of telemetry. And again, something that gives you insight as opposed to everything, because I think we're going to stop processing more and more than we can actually, even with machine learning, cope with. It needs to be insightful and, again, transparent. We need the user to understand this is what we're doing. And there's also a need for the relationship between the end user and what they're doing. They need to understand that if they do something, you know, sort of bad, it can affect the service they're going to get. Because for a long time, there hasn't been that relationship between IT and the business. It's, you know, IT beats up the business beats up IT. But if you tie into the best practices like rebooting your machine regularly, you know, sort of every 7 days, if you do a disk cleanup, you know, once in a while, if you close too many windows, you know, don't leave Excel running in the background for a month. Now, those sort of good hygiene things will improve their service. Uninstalling applications you're not using. That not only saves money for the organization because you get some sort of licensing back at some point, but also declutters the desktop. So you'll have a better experience regardless of whether you're in a Citrix session or you're in a virtualized session or you're in a desktop itself, physical desktop at least. So I think that's where it's going to be interesting to monitor that to see how that improves overall experience.
Yeah, this discussion gets to a point that I wanted to touch on. We've talked a lot about how really things are. All the action is happening on the user level now. We're thinking about just ways to speed up those processes, improve people's working lives. And you mentioned some practices about how people can, you know, close out tabs and things people can do to make their machines run better. But do you have any advice for IT on how to establish that sort of good technology citizenship? Or what are ways that you've worked on that in the past to sort of educate end users or get their buy-in and participation?
So you need an omni-channel approach. So ways to communicate with the user that are not in their face all the time, but are relevantly in their face. So things like we do some work around application monitoring. So if an application is taking too much resource, too much CPU, or too much memory, we pop up an alarm with a screen saying, you know, Outlook is taking up too much CPU. Can we close it? Or is this normal? Are you okay? You know, those sort of interactions.
To the user,
on their desktop. Other things that we do, as I said, the reboot cycle, we have a pop-up for that. It says, you know, your machine will reboot in 7 days. This might be 2 or 3 days before the reboot. They've got 2 or 3 days to finish up what they're doing, make sure there's nothing left open that potentially would be unsaved at the time of reboot. But at 7 days, it'll force the reboot and their machine will be refreshed. We've had cases where machines have run for a year and you can see a degradation in performance because it needs that, you know, resource clear. There's an education piece to this as well. I think users need to understand a bit more about what they're using, and some of that comes back to how-to articles and self-help, and if you ever read the book Shadow Work, it's around the same sort of concept, where if you go to the grocery store, you may have had someone pack your bags at some point. Now you would pack your own bags because that's work that you're going to do, but the store would still have the same sort of service cost because someone's less to pack the bag. The difference is that ownership's gone from being a bag packer who worked for the store to you as the customer packing your own bag. Some of the IT stuff, because of cost cutting and changes in direction, there aren't those people to do those tasks for you in the support side or the IT side, so the end user has to do that. So they have to. There's a little bit of encroachment to understand how that's going to impact. So examples, again, removing applications you don't use, but also files you don't use. There's so many people that will store an Excel spreadsheet for years and years and years because they might need it, or archive their mail into a PST file, and you'll have gigs and gigs of these mails. But you don't necessarily need them, and there are already practices internally where mail that's important will be archived for 5 or 10 years to comply with legislation. So there's all those little things that the end user is becoming more and more aware of to improve that performance.
And do you find that people are generally malleable there? Have you noticed that people are you willing to make those changes? You know, when they get that alarm, are they doing as suggested?
Yeah. So we've done some stuff with gamification the last couple solutions. And we've put a score on it now, which is interesting because that score is so much based on what they do as well as what the service they get provided with. So there's always a bit of an argument about really if I'm a 92%, am I really at 92%? If I'm a 50%, why am I 50%? And you can point at sometimes, you didn't reboot your machine on schedule. You ignored all our warnings. You have all these files that you refuse to get rid of. You haven't run the latest version of the software we've asked you to run. We do quite a lot around unauthorized software as well. So if you've got a version of Chrome that's not supported by the organization, but we have asked you to switch over and you refuse to do that, it's going to impact your score. So there's a bit of a give and take, and there's a metric that ties it all together. The other things that we've found is that it creates, because it's gamification, it creates a team versus team scenario sometimes, which is, some people say it's good, some people say it's bad, but it is driving the right behaviors. And I think what happens is, again, you've educated some users, so you'll go to the next level, which will be, you fixed this problem. Can you fix these other problems? Which before they wouldn't even bring to you because you hadn't fixed the basic problem yet. So there's that trust that's now been built up and that credibility that's been built up with some evidence that's more metric-driven as opposed to opinion-driven, because that's the other problem. You had previously be, my computer's slow, but there'd be no evidence to say why it was slow or no investigative work to say, we can see it's slow because you've got a shared mailbox and you are based in London, but your mailbox is in Australia. Do you really need the mailbox?
Yeah. Do you feel like this approach has sort of built up the trust relationship a little bit better between IT and end users?
It's trust as long as it's kept transparent. So what we do is if a user complains, we'll get a ticket or we'll get a conversation with a senior stakeholder, will come back to us and we'll go talk to the user. We'll show them the tools we're using. We'll say, this is what we can see. We'll share the screen. We'll show them exactly what we can see. And we'll show them a dependency diagram that shows, the latency. And we'll say, you're in Australia. Your mailbox is in Australia. You're in London. The speed of light problem is what it is. You're going to have a 200 millisecond latency, but you really need the mailbox. Actually, I don't really need the mailbox. So if we get rid of that, it'll improve your performance. So there's that kind of conversation. And if that works, then that user becomes your best spokesperson because they're going to tell the next person, I had this problem and they showed me what they did and they fixed my problem. So that builds credibility. Whereas if you tell them that you're fixing all these things and they don't see it personally, they go, that's just politics. There's no substance behind it.
It's actually funny that you bring that up because I used to work like a level one IT person, and every once in a while someone will come in and be like, my computer's running slow, I don't know why. But you're looking at it and for me, it never seemed to be that slow.
Yeah.
And then sometimes the answer was as simple as, your computer is like 30 years old. That's why it's running slow.
30 years.
Yeah. Like, do people bring in like ancient things? They like set up a whole tower and everything. And you're just looking at them like, I have a guess, but then they don't trust you because they're saying, oh, you just want me to buy a computer again. Well, so it's
like a puncture in your tire.
Mm-hmm.
You want the puncture fixed, or they want to sell you new tires. Oh, I'll just fix the puncture. I had an example. I can't think of what it was now. Look up to me.
Yeah, obviously, it's always going to be a little bit easier on the enterprise side when you're giving people the technologies versus on the consumer side when you're, you know, I feel like we have a tendency more to hold on to all the old devices. Although I guess in the enterprise too, people get used to things. And so one thing that's sort of hovering in the background with this discussion, at least in Europe, is the new GDPR regulation, which I believe goes into effect in May of 2018, but a lot of enterprises obviously have to start preparing sooner. Have you felt the effects of that? Have you had to make many changes to your strategies, or what's the general sentiment, I guess?
So there's a program that's running to prepare the organization that I'm with now to deal with it. Most of what we do anyway is protected, so we always have a anytime you can input free text on a screen as a warning saying, please do not input, you know, sensitive information or personal information anyway. However, when we look at what we're collecting with some of our tools, there is some individual information in that. And we need to update our processes on how to collect that information. And as I mentioned a bit earlier about how you allow the user to have that deleted. And one of the things that we're waiting for our legal team to come back on is, could you treat aging out of data as a way of deleting the data anyway? Because if the user leaves and the data's gone in 30 days after they leave, do we have to go and physically delete the data if it's already been processed out? The other things that we have to consider is in some of the restricted countries, so things like the worker councils, they have some rules and regulations around what you can collect and who can see that data. So if a person's launching applications and spending time in applications, their management chain can't see that information without going through an approval process that includes risk and compliance. The other things that we have to factor in there is that we have to keep a copy of that data locally in the country before it ships out to somewhere else for processing. And that's something else that GDPR is quite focused on, is that moving of data across borders. You have to pick a country where almost is your headquarters for data processing, and that'll be your lead authority on how you treat data, how you process data, how you clean it. And then if there's anything around, again, having it deleted, or if there's any breaches, it'll be based on how you've determined your procedures and your structure. So there's quite a lot to it. And GDPR, obviously, if you don't know, it's got some legal binding attached to it, as opposed to DPA, which was the previous one, which was just a set of guidelines.
The Data Protection Act.
Correct.
Yeah.
So the Experian thing, the Equifax thing, recently would have had some serious penalties. In fact, I attended a GDPR talk where the breach that happened with one of the local ISPs, I think they were fined £250,000, would have been closer to £20 million under GDPR.
Wow, yeah.
So significantly different fine.
I know the fines
fine.
Are, yeah, much stricter now.
Yeah.
And I believe Germany was mostly the country you were alluding to with the strictest.
Yeah, Germany, Luxembourg, Netherlands, France as well. There's 27 countries generally that are restricted or treated as restricted countries.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like, I mean, having already had parts of your business there, has that sort of helped you get a head start in sort of preparing?
Yeah, we were a little bit more tuned to it. It's not a new conversation. It's something that we've kind of had to deal with before. For business reasons as opposed to legislative reasons. Now it's legislative as well, so we're a little bit better geared up for that. The other thing that's been interesting is that we've not been invited to those conversations before, and now we've been invited to those conversations. So previously someone else would have handled that, and we wouldn't have been allowed in the room. Now we're part of that conversation. We're preparing the materials. We're engaged.
I guess I'm interested to hear sort of, so I know the right to be forgotten is a big deal, sort of anonymization. How do you handle specific end user problems without sort of knowing, attaching a person to a computer?
So interesting enough, the anonymization, as much as we've been asked if we can do it, hasn't actually ever been turned on. So, and there's business reasons for that as opposed to compliance reasons. So in the migration of a group of users, if we don't know who they are, we have to give them all the same applications, the same resources, it becomes more expensive than it's worth to move them. And often when you have a discussion with, again, this, and this is part of the GDPR thing now, is you, when you go and talk to users and you get their consent, they're less worried about it because they know what you can use the data for. So there's always an exception provided the end user is aware and they give their full consent.
I mean, the key is that the reason you're collecting this data is to make their work life better.
Yep.
So when rolling out new end user computing technologies, how do you measure the success of their deployment and adoption? And like, how do you ensure that it remains stable?
So there's a need to understand the user, what they've got now, what tools they have. So whether they're on a laptop or a physical desktop, what they do is in a daily activity. So we like to have some level of KPIs to say what applications you use all the time, what kind of resource utilization do you have, so how much CPU do you use, how much memory do you use. When we put them onto a different platform, and most of them are moving to a VDI of some sort, either persistent or non-persistent, we're looking at that as well to do a comparison. So if we know that they use 60 gigs of storage, and they use 6 gigs of RAM, and they've got dual core processor, when we put them onto the VDI environment, whichever one it is, we want to make sure that they've at least got the same, if not better, because of the obviously more modern technologies to that. A further part to this is actually talking to the users. So driving that through, we talked about the bots but earlier. Sometimes we actually just pick up the phone and talk to them. And we look at the data we've collected around something like the health score or the alarms that are firing off from the workstation that they're on. And we ask them, do you see the same things that we see? How do you feel about your experience? We have a survey that goes out as a general, sort of 10 points that we'd ask them to answer. We've cut that down to 5 now just to make it easier to get answers to. And it's very binary in the sense of, is it good or bad? Is your experience good? Is it bad? Has it improved since you moved? And we do try and ask those questions, not once, but maybe a few times to see if things improve over time or get worse over time. We also tie it back to the employee survey. So there's a yearly employee survey that drives not just technology questions, but general things. So obviously we want to get the view that's beyond just giving someone a tool. We want to make sure that their work life is good too. We also, as I mentioned, are transparent with that data. So we show them how we measure things. And if we get it wrong, we also show them where we got it wrong. So if we've given them the wrong application or we've not packaged an application because we thought they didn't need it because it was called something else, we had that with some IBM tools that were called something different and we never packaged them for the new platform. And then we found out that actually, some of our critical users needed them. We're quick to respond and take the hit for making a mistake, but recover quickly to fix the problem. So that's important to it as well.
Yeah, sort of that multifaceted approach of where you mentioned something like a health score where you have, all of that KPI data you were talking about condensed into this one score that tells you something about your environment and that you can track for the user. And then also, I think, obviously, that helps from an IT angle, see what's really going on, and then coupling that with something like the survey, and you get the sentiment and you get their perception. Sounds like a really powerful way to really understand the success of initiatives, because obviously it's great if things are working from the IT end and we can see it. But I think also having that the user feedback is really key, because they're the ones obviously actually using those yep. technologies. Yep.
Have you ever seen, out of personal curiosity, if you ask the person how their experience is going, have you ever seen them say like, yeah, it's going great, and their like KPIs and score is just shot?
Yeah, we see that actually quite a lot. And in both ways. Sometimes we see a user that's got almost 100% score, but they feel like everything is terrible. And it's certain applications doing certain things. So for a long time, I mean, our Skype for Business success rate or or call carry through rate is like 97%, 98%. But there's always one person that just has a poor experience. Their calls drop, they can't join conference calls, but there's no real reason that it shouldn't work. But if they see their health score, the health score is high, and they go, that's not a fair reflection of my experience because Skype never works for me. And it comes down to, you know, things like using an unapproved desktop device for doing their calls. Sometimes it's just a case of spending the time, not necessarily arguing about who's right or wrong, but trying to understand, but more beyond the score. We've had users that have had a health score almost at zero, but because of what they do, they don't see it. And we see it and we go, well, surely it's bad. I'm like, no, it's fine. It's just like my laptop. My laptop was also slow. And it shouldn't be slow on the newer platform. So it's both.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of, based on the user's perception of how technology should be performing and maybe their prior experiences and their needs, it's going to vary.
And I think there's a cultural thing to it too. Depending on where you come from and you know, sort of how you grew up, some people don't complain. They expect it to get better anyway. And as long as they carry on doing their job and no one sort of tells them there's a problem, they'll just carry on. And you'll get some people that you know, can always be better, so they'll always find something that they can not necessarily moan about, but point out and say, well, you know, this is, you know, today was slower today, so there's something wrong, you need to go look at it. And that could just be, and then this comes back to the sort of evolving workplace, because there's so many different things now tying together. Your complexities are there, that there's always something that could affect the experience at that given time, which won't be necessary there tomorrow. So what we're doing around synthetic transactions is we're testing certain things based on knowing who our users are and what they do. We're testing connectivity to the internet. We're testing connectivity to websites they go to often. We're testing sending an email and getting an email back. So there's almost the rights that they deserve as an end user. We're testing those things to make sure they're always good. Because sometimes there's a problem with that piece at a certain time of day, but when we go look at the problem when they've raised the ticket, it's not the same time, so we don't see that problem. And we did some work with ticket analysis where we found that often a user wouldn't raise a ticket at the time of the problem. They'd raise a ticket 7 days after the problem. And by then, all the data's gone. So there's no, you know, there's no way to easily solve that problem. So we're trying to do proactive healing or proactive fixes. And sometimes that means we have a few false positives. We will say there's a problem because we detected what we thought were the metrics that said this was the problem. And the user said, there actually was no problem there. I don't know what you're doing. This thing's so stupid. Why have I got this? But, you know, in order to improve things, you need to try and fail fast if it doesn't work. And if it works, improve it quickly for the next iteration.
So you were saying the synthetic transactions, you get false flags?
Not so much false flags, but sometimes if we browse certain websites, sometimes they load quickly, sometimes they load slowly. And that could be that website, you know, whatever it is, say Google for argument's sake. It could be slow because at that time of day, we're running a change and we're changing the proxies, or the proxies are refreshing. So at 9 o'clock in the morning, they're slow, but at 2 o'clock, they're fast. Or at 5 o'clock, they're slow because everyone's sort of reached the end of the day and they're kind of doing their, you know, research or drifting off into daydreaming kind of stuff. So that's the whole point of the synthetics, is to have constant samples that are giving you a feel for why or when to look for problems. Because at that point in time, we may want to do something. And this is the move to the cloud in the sense of increasing the computing power to handle those sort of peaks and troughs and give it and take it back as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing, or what we considered at least around virtual desktop, is you could give people more compute at times they need it. So a billing run or end of quarter or end of a month where they had to do more work, where they need more resource. But there'd be other people that might potentially on leave that we can take their machines back and use that resource to give to those that need it more at that time. So the whole elastic compute scenario.
And have you been able to sort of, do you compare that synthetic transaction data to sort of the real-time environment? And have you looked at those together?
Yeah, so we do a couple of things. One, we do it from different parts of the world. So we have people all over the place where we've deployed the synthetic components to do the tests themselves. So we'll have someone in Singapore, someone in Switzerland, someone in the UK, someone in Australia, someone in New York, you know, different places all hitting the same place, sitting in the same website, sending the same email. So it's round tripping and coming back. And compare those all the time to see if there's any disparities. And you'd expect, you know, if we do a couple hundred a day, you'd expect, you get an average and you expect to be on either side of that average within, you know, 10% or 15%. If you start seeing spikes, then that's when we go look and say, well, maybe we've got a network problem. So we have a branch network. We've seen some problems with sending email, which to the average user, they wouldn't really mind because they've clicked send. It's gone to the outbox. It's been processed. It's been sent. But that synchronization between the Outlook client and Exchange is taking longer than it should. If they were doing 100 emails, they would see a problem. But one or two here and there, we get away with it. So it's that, you know, sort of fine-tuning or looking for where there's potential. We talked about that whole end-to-end process, finding those things that we can improve before they become a problem.
I guess this might be out there, and I don't know if you sort of segment users in this way or not, but do you notice sort of as a global enterprise, do you notice discrepancies in sort of attitudes or even just like the user experience depending on where people are located in the world or even maybe even age? That's probably something you don't track for, but I am just curious, you know. I think we have this perception that a lot of these workplace changes are happening to sort of appease the millennials, or that this is sort of a driving force when we talk about how the consumerization of IT. I think definitely people, the younger tech-savvy generation coming in, obviously there's people of all ages who are tech-savvy and not tech-savvy, but just sort of wondering, do you see discrepancies in different populations?
I mean, it's more cultural than data-driven that I've seen. So because you can work from home, or you can work from anywhere in the world in some cases, I mean, email, an internet connection, you can get the internet pretty much anywhere. If you look at some of the African countries, I mean, they had mobile payments before they had internet in some places. So what I found interesting is the cultural difference, where you may have a boss that thinks you need to be at your desk 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, to do your work. Whereas if you're working with sort of the younger generation, they will, I can work between having my coffee in the morning, I can do 10 emails, or I could write that, you know, that document I need to write at home because I'm less distracted. But they feel stifled because now their boss is saying, well, I need to see you at your desk 9 to 5. And in that desk they're going to be sitting at, they're probably in an open plan office where around them is noise and they can't concentrate. So, you know, you're losing productivity in some senses. I think that's more prevalent and less data driven than for enough, more opinion driven. And I think that's what will need to change. The other thing, this concept of the blend between work life and personal life, you know, doing that quick email while you're sitting watching your kid do swimming lessons or something like that, has meant that people work more, but they're not necessarily as, say, committed. But they don't have to feel this anxiety of being in the office to do the work. They can do that quick thing. They almost schedule their work based on their lifestyle. So they'll do the brain work in the morning over coffee before the kids, while the kids are getting up. They may do their sort of quick email responses on the commute on the train, because that's 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or even an hour of going through email. And then they might do their social stuff when they get to the office, because they need to catch up with people and collaborate and whiteboard and brainstorm, etc. And then they know they've got 2 hours tonight when they get home, after they put the kids to bed and had dinner with their spouse, to do you know, some sort of PowerPoint deck or whatever they need, you know, the quiet time again to do. So I think that's culture going to change. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen the data yet because we haven't really looked at that kind of stuff, but I think we will. And that comes back to the bots again. We want to provide ways to get for users to do more work and not necessarily have to support them with people to be available to help them with a support ticket or fix something for them, where a bot could potentially give them the help, how to, or we could fix something automatically. So they can carry on doing, so the lifestyle blend becomes enabled, because we're now saying, well, work at home if you want. And if you need help, talk to the bot, because the bot will go find out for you. And yes, there might be still an operations center waiting for the extreme case or the exception, but they're only worrying about that, not managing the entire environment, which is, you know, too big to manage in some cases.
So you're talking about how people will be able to work more like remotely and like on their own time. Do you think that'll affect anything, I guess? So I know like humans naturally are just like kind of like the team building, like they like communication. Do you think that's going to like any affect any kind of like?
Well, it depends on what you're doing, what your job is. And also depend. I mean, there's a lot of thinking around now about people having multiple jobs, not just having one. I think there's some tasks that are better to be done by yourself. So I like to write a document. I like to be on my own. But sometimes if I'm designing something, I like to draw it on the whiteboard, get in early, have my music on, my headphones or whatever, and then go grab the first person that comes to the door that I know and go, come, I want to show you this thing. And you can't necessarily do that when you're remote and they're remote. And so I think there's still a need to have people in a room, but I don't think there needs to be the pressure to be in an office 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. I also think that because of some of the globalization that's happened, you have resources that sit in different countries because of expertise or cost or whatever it is. And I also think that the cost of having a building for a corporation now sometimes is not worth the cost for what they think. And you're going to almost have hotspot areas or reusable office space that they'll share with other organizations of the same type. It might be easier for people that work for the organization to get to, but they're not formal offices. So Regis, which is a UK brand, I think they've got offices here in the US as well. You get a membership card. It gives you, 100 hours a year to go in and use the meeting rooms and get coffee and all that kind of stuff. You might meet your team there for a day, and it might cost a couple hundred bucks for the day to have access to a meeting room, but you're not paying a couple grand for a space that, not everyone sits at every day.
Yeah. It makes sense.
I was just going to say, I read somewhere that Marriott is now renting out part of their, you can rent a spot in their lobby to have that as your workplace for the day. Mm-hmm. If you're someone who's a freelancer or something who wants a meeting space. So that's definitely.
I had a very good conversation with a friend of mine. She used to work for a big corporate, went off on her own. And one of her corporate friends said, look, I've got a job for you. We'll pay you this amount of money. And she said, well, unless you can find a situation where my dog can sit with me all day long, mm-hmm. and I can wake up, I can be at my desk in 25 minutes, and that includes showering and breakfast, I'm not coming to work for you. And they said, we can't do that because you have to drive to the office. So I don't want the job. And it was that simple. I mean, her mm-hmm. job is exactly the same job, but she has the creature comforts of what she wants, and she's happy with what she's doing. And, if she doesn't want to work that day, okay, it's her own business. She doesn't have to work. But if she also wants to go on holiday and work 2 days while on holiday, her office is, her technology that she needs for, or the tools that she needs for her job.
So I think we've sort of talked a lot about where we sort of, especially you, Ryan, obviously, where you see this space going, the sort of the future of what work looks like and what IT is going to look like. Are there any things sort of in the next few years that you'd expect to change, or you'd like to see change, or where do you see the direction headed?
Yeah, so I think there'll be more specific applications built for the mobile devices that give people the ability to work more flexibly. So sort of bring your own app on top of the bring your own device, mm-hmm. Which started off originally. Having the in order to do that, you'd have to understand what users do, how they work. But I see that becoming more and more common in the similar thinking to cut away from over-engineering in some senses, building, again, back to offices that aren't always going to be filled up. You want people working from home. You want them comfortable with specific brain tasks they're going to use. So I'd like to see that happening. Personally, I like to work in a flexible way. So I like to go to the coffee shop and do a bit of work there and do a bit of work on the commute. So being enabled to do that works for me. For some people, that doesn't work. But the idea of being able to do a whiteboard conversation with someone in another country would be, so I think that's a dream that a few people have, proper brainstorming without having to fly, 10, 12 hours to get there. And maybe even to the point of sort of avatars and holographic video conferencing where you're in your pajamas, but you look like you're in a suit.
That would be the dream, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great sort of aspirational dream to end on. Thanks so much again to Ryan Purvis for joining us for this conversation about end users in the workplace. That's it for our show today. If you like to subscribe, you can find us on your favorite podcast platform. It'd be so wonderful if you could rate a review. That would really help us get some more eyes on it. And as always, you can contact us at lifeguardit@lakesidesoftware.com. Thanks for listening.